heart and soul of a nation, beckons the call. The voice of our forefathers heard in the distance.
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
To reclaim our honor.
Our soul. The challenges of a generation call out. Future generations hang in the balance. We choose liberty. This is the voice of a nation.
The nation.
And now, Malcolm.
You remember those rallies, friends, the Tea Party rallies? What happened to the Tea Party? You remember those movements? In fact, as I recall back in my early days of, I had actually just got into radio then, from the corporate boardrooms, and I remember we had the Occupy movement, the Wall Street on one side, you know, and then we had the Tea Party movement. And that was a lot of the national conversation, what was happening there. A lot of this was to do because of our taxes, our taxation, but also a piece of it, a lot of the talking points became the debt as well. And where's the country headed exactly? And the Tea Party actually did a lot of things. I mean, to me, I think they were trying to bring, in many ways, the Republican Party back to some level of conservatism, because I think the two had departed for a while there, the conservatism and the Republican Party. And that had to do with really over a lot of years. I mean, a lot of presidents, a lot of administrations that I think took for granted. And I think this becomes then a, like everything else, a runaway a freight train here. When you look at our national debt and our financial responsibility, I mean, right now, as it is, the economy has been doing really well. That's a big deal. You know? And there were certain milestones that Trump had put into place, by the way, prior to him coming into office, and including what sort of growth. Because you remember in the previous administration, they were running around that 1% if they were lucky, 1.5%. They said, well, we'll never get back to 3% again. Of course, we've been doing that. And actually, when Trump ran, believe it or not, he was actually talking about, he had some pretty hefty goals. I mean, he was talking about 5-6%. And a lot of it, too, is, again, our GDP. Nobody really talks about what's our GDP to our national debt. Because if they're both increasing, that's one thing. But if the debt is outpacing that, then we have troubles. The big takeaway up front I want you to take on this is that the American debt per citizen right now is at about $67,000 per citizen. That's a big number. Now, I don't know if you've gone to the U.S. debt clock. There's a website that tracks this thing, people. usdebtclock.org. And it's fascinating if you haven't been there. Now, always do that after happy hour because you'll want to be lubricated when you look at this thing. It's really something else. But you'll see how fast the debt that we take on here in the country. Now, you ask yourself, should I be concerned? But if I say to you, if I arrived at your home with a bill for $67,000 that you needed to pay, that was the debt of every man, woman, and child in the country, that would be significant. And you say, well, I don't have 67 extra grand. I wasn't planning to pay you today, Uncle Sam. But I guess if that debt came due and we all had to pay our piece, that would be quite something, wouldn't it be? You know, I used to use the term, the country is bankrupt. What did that really mean? Well, it comes back to a basic financial sheet here, balance sheet, assets and liabilities, basic fundamental 101. That's all it is. You know, when you get in business or even your household budget, for instance, or a business budget, whatever, you have to have a budget. You have your assets, your liabilities, and, you know, you balance this thing out, right? Hopefully you're paying the bills and you have a few bucks left at the end of the day. It's a good day, clearly. I think we all hope to be that. Maybe we run our homes that way, our businesses that way, hopefully. The federal government people, not so much. They don't run it that way. We have a debt ceiling in this country, a debt ceiling. And they just keep raising the debt ceiling. That's what the politicians do every time they need more money. So now if you or I went to a bank and we needed more money and we didn't pay our bills previously and the balance sheet wasn't there, you know what the bank would tell us, right? I mean, you know full well, you'd be leaving the bank in tears, possibly, if you were fool enough to go there to ask to begin with. But when it comes to the feds and the federal government, it's a different animal. They don't beat to the balance sheet of what we have to in our lives and our homes and our businesses. They're at a different level of thinking here. Now, I like to break it down to that simple denominator. Simple stuff. Just like we all have a budget in our homes, our businesses, what does it mean for the national debt? Well, friends, the national debt in this country is a record over $22 trillion. That's here as of quarter two in 2019. And again, you can go to that usdebtclock.org if you care to do that and measure it moment by moment, second by second, minute by minute, hour by hour. And you can see the debt this country takes on. Now, a lot of this is just reckless. It's reckless spending, but it's also taxation at times that is out of control. Again, it comes back to that conversation that you'll actually hear this in the 2020 election quite a bit come. This talk today is very relevant, actually, to the 2020 race. Because what you're going to hear in the 2020 race, you got a lot of socialism coming out of the closet here. And, you know, if you're going to start giving away free everything and free education and free health care, and you're going to try to do any sort of semblance of order and just start giving things away, I mean, they're talking about reparations for all kinds of people. You see reparations for Black America, reparations for the gay community, reparations for just everybody's got a new form of reparation. They think the government's got an endless supply of money. Just borrow more from China, right? That was the old saying we used to say 10, 20 years ago. China owes a lot of, they own a lot of our debt. So does the UK. A lot of countries buy in American debt. Well, because, again, they feel like American solvency is good. They feel like, you know why they're doing that? They're banking on you out there, the taxpayer, the American citizen, we the people. That's who they're banking on. They certainly ain't banking on Congress or the feds. They're banking on us. Because that's, again, what I always say, American exceptionalism. That's the people. They know that this country is, it's an attitude that doesn't exist anywhere on the planet. And that should make you all optimistic. I should give everybody an optimism. And there's a beautiful thing about Americans. It's a beautiful thing about this country. And Trump recognized that coming in as a president. He knew damn well that this country is the most resourceful country on the planet. He also knew we can do incredible things. He knew with the right leadership, the sky was the limit, people. There is no limit at that point, is there now? But friends, the irresponsibility of Congress, the consistently of raising the debt ceiling, which will come up again this year. This is going to happen in the fall time again as budgets come into play and the country will find themselves with no money and they'll need to raise the debt ceiling again. And the feds will need to borrow more. And that's what happens. That's how this works here. And they don't pay it back is the problem. Now, I wanted to give you a little bit of historical perspective of this today and why this matters. And what to me is relevant about this, And I just, you know, as we talk about this today and we discuss more of the this attitude of a Tea Party, the Tea Party has a special place of our history, actually, here. It has a special place in American politics. You conjure up certain feelings and thoughts when you hear that word Tea Party. You tend to think of the early patriots and what had happened in the Boston Harbor there. You think of why, what America was, the early days of America. And how we were and how when we broke off from Great Britain, what this thing was all about, right? I mean, taxation without representation. That still holds true today. Do you have proper representation today from Congress? I don't think so. In a lot of ways, that's an argument you could still have today, in fact. I've been talking about that in recent days to y'all. That's an argument we could have right today. But let's take a look at a little historical perspective a moment here. So on the day that Barack Obama was sworn into office in his administration, that was on January 20th, 2009, the debt was about $10 trillion. When he left the White House in 2017, on January 20th, it was just topping $20 trillion. To be precise, 19.947. We would say that's $20 trillion, people. You round that real quickly, right? So he doubled the debt, basically, pretty close to doubling the debt. And that kind of created some problems here. But the president before him did the same thing. George W. Bush did the same thing. He added almost $6 trillion to the debt. That was the second greatest dollar amount. Obama's was the first. And that was like 101% growth of the debt. Incredible dollars here. But you got to remember now, George Bush, he, in all fairness, he had to launch the war on terror. You had the 9/11 attacks, remember? You had the war in Afghanistan was $1.1 trillion, and the Iraq war was another $1 trillion. These are big ticket items by any stretch, and the military spending was at record levels. Now, Obama sliced the military spending, and the military felt it, and the equipment started to get older, and there were other problems there. So, you know, the first and foremost, I think you would agree with me, the biggest responsibility of the federal government is to keep the nation safe. And that means the biggest responsibility is we have to have military spending. That's not something you want to be short-sighted about, people. That's not something you want to start to cut and slice and dice. You have to be ready, or you're playing with fire. If you don't, there'll be no country left. There are a lot of people that want to see America dead out there. Remember that. Can never lose sight of that. But if we look at projections right now with the Trump administration now, Trump said some interesting things through the campaign. He said some fascinating things, actually, that he was going to help bring this debt under control. He hasn't done that to date. Of course, he's not having any help as well by anyone, by any stretch of the imagination. But this is going to become back of a problem. You're not hearing much about the debt right now. But come later this year, and as we get into the 20 election, it's going to come in full throttle. In fact, when you start to see the candidacy of the far left and all the free stuff they want to bring to the table, when this all happens here, later this year, and as we get into the 20 campaign, I'm telling you now, this debt is going to be a big, it's going to come full circle again. And it's going to be ready for another, we'll be ready, this country will, for another Tea Party movement in a big way. I'm not saying the Tea Party went anywhere, but the point is it'll become more front and center is what I'm saying, more in the media vernacular. We'll be talking about it at the water cooler, probably. And as we see all the free stuff they want to bring on that the government can't afford, and then you got people like Sanders who wants to tax Wall Street and everything that moves so he can give away free to the have-nots, and then you get the full effect, people, of what a Robin Hood program looks like today. And that's what they want. They want to equal the level. It's a very strange conversation. It's not really capitalism. It's not, doesn't feel like America, but that's what these people are talking about, a socialism in a way. In a big way, communism for some. I mean, they're really looking for government to run everything, to control every part of your life. They want it to be, you know, like Denmark and Sweden and Finland and all of these sort of countries that where 70, 80% of your paycheck goes to the feds and they do everything but wipe your ass, pretty much. Some of them probably do that, in fact. I don't know. But you look at these dollars here, and, you know, it's projected now Donald Trump again. This is going to become a campaign issue, I think. And I think you're going to see Trump's going to have to take control of this because he's plans that right now he's projected to add just almost, well, over $5 trillion to the debt will be complete in his first term when he finishes up here is what it's projected to be. That's a 30% increase from the 20-plus trillion debt at the end of Obama's budget. You see, we're already at 22. What Obama left it was 20.245 trillion in debt. You get the picture. Now, if he remains in office for a second term and things don't change, he plans to add another 9.1 trillion. This is what the budgets show. Now, the problem with this is he had promised to eliminate the debt during his campaign. I mean, I call it as I see it. He's not really talking about the debt. It's not, the media's not, nobody's talking about the debt. Nobody's talking about what's happening right now. And that's what happens. We have short-sighted memories in this country. We'll continue to go on until it becomes a problem. Then it will be a problem. It's like everything else we do here, you know. We're reactive. We're never proactive. We wait till the you-know-what hits the fan. And then we have some lame excuse of some sort. Or it'll become the biggest talking point, or somebody will have to come up with an idea. And that'll become the campaign issue. And this could still come out as a big 2020 program, especially as we get through the fall time budgets and the debt ceiling conversation. There'll be some headlines about this. So we're talking early about this right now, I'm telling you. But it's, you're going to hear this. It'll be all over the place shortly. And so as we step back now and we look, we're at an interesting point of time. We have some economic power right now. So the GDP, I mean, that's increasing, which allows a little more sustainability for the debt, really, people. But shouldn't we be taking advantage of that? There are some economists say that's when you should be able to really handle the debt, manhandle the debt, bring it down a little bit, but we're not doing that. And that's when some economists would say we need to make some progress toward the debt because things are looking good economically, but it's not come up as a front and central point yet. I have to believe it's going to at some point. And I don't believe this president is that reckless that when he leaves the second term, and I certainly hope and pray not, that we don't end up over $30 trillion, people. God, I hope not. So where's all this taking us today, people? Where are we at? Well, part of the conversation I want to have with you today is about this Tea Party movement. To me, this was a part of the conservative movement that was trying to bring the Republicans back to their senses and trying to understand what are we doing? You know, it's the old question, people. It's taxation without representation or taxation with piss poor representation. Pick your poison, either one, right? And this was the whole fight of why we had that fight in the harbor, why we dumped the tea into the harbor up there in Boston back in 1773, right? So there is a modern day Tea Party. You've been hearing about it. And today we'll take that on, friends. We'll talk about this, misrepresentation. Are you happy with your representation in Washington? I don't think anybody can say they really are. That's the question today we need to ask ourselves. And how big of a focus will this be in the 2020 race here, right? And the debt, does it really matter? Again, hooray for me and the hell with you. Just turn it off and turn the channel. Nobody's really paying attention, right? Because that's what everybody does here. They don't really pay attention until it's a problem. Isn't that the case? God, if we could only be a country that was proactive. Imagine what we could do together.
Listen to Malcolm, the voice of a nation, on iHeartRadio or our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa.
The Out and Out Perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutloud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Joining me on the program, Michael Johns. And why this conversation is relevant is Michael is the national co-founder and leader of the Tea Party movement. He's a former White House speechwriter, policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. I really looked at it as two camps. There was this Tea Party sort of trying to, in some ways, Michael, this is my talk here, my language, but smack the Republican Party in the head to wake them up, that they had lost the roots of, that's what I would say. I don't know what you'll say. You'll tell me now. And the other thing, you had that whole Occupy movement going on at the time. As, remember, that's when I entered into the arena here. Well, we sort of have, we're not, we've lost sight of now where we are as a nation, I think, with the debt. And I do have a feeling this is going to cycle around a bit. What's your sense of that? Do you see that happening as well, or am I way off base?
Well, firstly, if you go back 10 years to the founding of the Tea Party movement and, you know, and also the, as you correctly said, the activity around the Occupy movement, the common denominator with both was they were sort of organic manifestations of political activism among the American people who did not feel they were being properly represented in Washington. And in the case of the Tea Party movement, they looked at a House of Representatives that was being controlled by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats before they regained, again, control in 18, the Senate that was being controlled by Harry Reid and the Democrats, a president-elect in Obama who had taken office with a perceived mandate that was completely alien to most Americans and perceived to be very radicalized, and a media culture and academic culture, all of which were in that camp. So for tens of millions of Americans who looked upon Washington and segments of influence in society, they did not feel properly represented. I think that's the genius of what the Tea Party movement has done to date, is to offer an opportunity for political and policy engagement by the American people that did not historically exist. I mean, there are many Tea Party activists might consider themselves Republicans, probably just as many consider themselves independents, but the party mechanisms themselves didn't really afford that level of activism, except perhaps around an election cycle. And this, I think, really afforded more of an ongoing opportunity for them to be politically engaged. And, you know, while I was never a part of the Occupy movement, I think there was a certain degree of sympathy among Tea Party leadership and activists with the sentiment that, the bank bailout really rewarded those who had been essentially most responsible for the the recessionary climate that emerged in the housing crisis. And it was an inverse of logic. And while that was a much more radical and predominantly left of center movement, it did represent, to their credit, a proper degree of skepticism with some of the institutions that we've come to rely on, and certainly a great degree of skepticism about the way Congress and the administration at that point had handled that crisis. So all of that. Now, the debt crisis on your second part of your issue there is that is the debt, firstly, what is the debt? The debt in a federal capacity is our federal spending that has not really essentially been taxed yet. And its growth is often, in my view, a kind of metaphor for big government and big spending. I mean, when people say cut the debt, what are they really asking? Are they saying that we should have a surplus or that we should have completely zero? That's as much what they're saying on a federal level as what they're saying is that our government has become too big. It's spending too much in ways that are not warranted or justified under our Constitution, or immediately paying dividends for the advance of American interests. Now, on a state and local level,
they have to balance the budget on state and local.
Absolutely. You can suspend all of that thinking about the federal government.
That's right.
A state and local government absolutely have to balance their budget. If they can't meet their bond expenditures.
So, Michael, why do the feds get away with it? Why do they get away with it? Why?
I think ultimately the complexity of government and the way that Congress and the administration, to a certain extent too, are able to inoculate themselves from scrutiny, and the fact that the American people have a lot of other things going on other than politics. You know, they have families, they have jobs, and you know, which is why we've sort of allowed this entire thought group of leadership to emerge in Washington that represents various interests, presumably to represent the American people that haven't had the time to do that. But ultimately, and this has been a centerpiece of the Tea Party message, is that the American people have to be engaged. They have to be on top of these things. They have to work collaboratively, cooperatively toward constructive ends if we're going to have any positive effect in resolving these issues.
When I think of the Tea Party, Michael, I'm thinking about, in a simple terms, I'm thinking about minimal government. I mean, isn't that a simple definition for a Tea Party, minimal government?
It is. It's one of the three founding principles. Limited government was a centerpiece of the organization around the Tea Party movement, also adherence to the Constitution, which is very much aligned with that. Mm-hmm. The fact that government should not be doing anything that's not enumerated to it by our Constitution, which is one of the genius documents in the history of global governments. And then finally, lower taxes. T in essence standing for tax enough already, that we, between federal taxes, state taxes, local taxes, taxes on property, taxes on sales, the list goes on, and become an overtaxed nation.
This is going to be in direct conflict with the 2020 race, because now you've got all these candidates on the left who every single one of them, Michael, are running on big government. Every single one of them. I mean, this election, let's talk about that a moment. This election coming up now, to me, this is going to be unbelievable. I mean, if there's ever been a race that is going to be so at odds, you're talking about a complete 180 from the other. You're talking about a race coming up here about big government. No matter who is on the left, it's going to be big government versus I don't know what you call the other side. I don't really call it minimal government. I call it less than the other big government, the lesser of evil of big government. What would you call the other side? They're not minimal government, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, I think, President Trump, to his credit, talked extensively in the 2016 race about the forgotten man and woman, and that is that there are tens upon tens of millions of Americans who have not benefited from this largesse in government, and essentially have been isolated from many of the rewards. We have a country that's worked very well for the very wealthy, I think, as people on the right and left would concede. We also have a country, in the judgment, I think, of the Tea Party movement and the Trump administration, that's worked very well for the very poor. This is one of the few countries in the world where you essentially can go from cradle to grave with a great degree of security from federal and state programs that I think are necessary as a fallback position, but have become, in the minds of many too much of a go-to first starter, you know, that we have so many people on these programs who have not either been afforded the opportunity to work, have had bad education that hasn't given them the access to opportunities that otherwise exist, or in probably a smaller percentage of cases have not actually even pursued it. And, you know, so the forgotten man and woman, which is essentially the middle class of the country, has not really reaped the benefits that I think that really should be afforded to them. And now you have essentially setting up in 2020 two different completely methodologies for how to get that class back into a position of enjoying.
President Trump said he was going to absolutely work on the debt. He wanted to cut the debt down. That was part of his campaign. He hasn't been able to touch that anywhere near it. In fact, it's grown on the other side. How do you see this point playing at all into the 2020 race, or do you think it becomes a nil issue?
I think the problem in the discussion around the debt, and, you know, while Trump paid some lip service to it, really the centerpiece of his campaign was about getting, you know, the growth, as you said in your opening, over 3% and creating jobs. And
he's doing that.
And he's, you know, he's, like, to his credit, really executed on that well, and right, particularly well when you consider he hasn't really had the collaboration of Congress, not just in the last year, but in the first 2 years, even with the Republican-controlled Congress, didn't really get the level of collaboration and cooperation that I think was politically necessary. I think the debt becomes an issue only from the standpoint, because most Americans, if you'd asked them the question, how is the debt affecting you? Mm-hmm. Understandably, and to their credit, they probably struggle to kind of define that. I mean, from a strict economic standpoint, the cost of the debt typically is inflation, that you have more money chasing the same amount of goods, the prices on a supply and demand basis go up under that methodology. We have inflation largely contained in the country. It's kind of prominent in a few sectors. The two sectors, I think, interestingly, that it's most affected are the two sectors where the consumer is not directly paying for those goods: education, post-secondary education, and in healthcare. Those are two areas where inflation is a really, really big, serious problem. But the underlying contributing factor remains the methodologies to which those are paid, and the fact that you have a federal and in some cases state government so heavily engaged in those programs that it's creating a subsidy that's actually increasing the price of those goods. So I think it will come into play in discussion of those two sectors, particularly because those are two sectors that are really hurting the American people. I mean, they're finding a difficult time with both.
Do you see the Tea Party playing an active role in this next election?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you cannot underestimate the accomplishments to date of the Tea Party movement politically. I think it's widely appreciated that when you go back to that January 2009, Obama comes in, controls the administration, the courts are largely in the hands of the left, complete Congress with the House and Senate in the hands of the left. Everyone acknowledges that, well, what the Tea Party movement did was elect an entire wave of Tea Party aligned Republicans in the 2010 election. That blocked Obama's really ability to advance his agenda legislatively. And aside from Obamacare, frankly, very little was done in the way of major legislation. And then, of course, in 2014, with taking back the Senate, it also put some checks and balances on some of his more radical appointees from his confirmation standpoint. But less appreciated, and probably even more important in my view, is that it set up the 2016 race. It created a grassroots paradigm, political paradigm, that really allowed President Trump to run as a Republican, but against the Republican Party establishment. Mm-hmm. He did not run with the backing of the Republican Party. It's important to remember. He ran saying that the Republican Party had many things backwards. Mm-hmm. And in my view, this president has, in correcting some of those things, salvaged the Republican Party's national relevance. Now, he did that, you know, in his political methodology through a lot of very, very, very sizable rallies, filling whole stadiums, which really had not been done in our lifetime to date. That, of course, was a tactic that was utilized and developed by the Tea Party movement. And I think when you look at the MAGA movement in the country, which is huge and passionate and loyal. It derives a lot of its support from the Tea Party movement. I mean, there's been a lot of evolution from the Tea Party movement into the support for this president. Not all Tea Party activists from the very beginning endorsed Trump like I did from day one, but most started to come around to the conclusion that he represented the logical manifestation of these three founding principles. And that's undeniable. I mean, he's appointed judges who've been originalists and very committed to the adherence to the Constitution. He's, you know, begun to look and has developed some of the most sizable tax cuts in the history of the country, and reduced the regulations, which in turn have reduced the size of government and the scope of government in ways that have proven very constructive to this economy.
You know, with what you're saying, in a lot of ways, let's reflect on that a moment here. You know, in a very odd sort of way, Michael, Trump ran really as an independent, but hijacked the Republican Party to get it done.
Yeah, you know, hijacked it from some of the elitists, I think, who'd taken control of it, but did it in a way that was probably very much aligned with many registered Republicans and independents in the country who felt the Republican Party was becoming too much like the Democratic Party.
Oh, totally,
Really wasn't, you know, before Trump, offering the clear-cut alternative vision.
No, there was no alternative there. They became the Uniparty.
Yeah, and two of the best examples of that are immigration and trade, probably two of the biggest issues that are confronting our country right now that had been neglected by both parties. I mean, they paid rhetorical lip service to securing the border, but really did almost nothing. There was no major initiative in either party to reform this flawed immigration program and all the components of it that this president correctly is trying to get addressed. And then on trade, you know, we have three or four decades of bad trade agreements and bad trade arrangements that clearly were hurting this forgotten man and woman and working class Americans, that this president said, you know, no, these are two issues that are so so much at the centerpiece of the need of, to reform the country, that we're going to make them centerpieces of the Republican Party. And I believe that was critical from a policy standpoint, because it's created the conditions on which we can start to see some of the economic improvements we're seeing in the country, but it also salvaged politically the Republican Party from irrelevance, because in the absence of it being able to really identify those two issues as centerpiece to creating economic growth and prosperity for the middle class of this country, it would be very difficult, I think, to see a Republican Party having national relevance.
One of the most significant things that Trump did is the trade deals. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, when you think of the this president is the kind of leader, and I think you would agree with that, that rolls his sleeve up. He rolls his sleeves up. And he gets to work. So, in other words, he sees the problem. And this is the way, actually, this is the way all CEOs really think, people, is that so when you see a problem, you want to fix the problem. You see, you want, and another thing about a good CEO, they want to make molehills out of mountains. They want to reduce the problem before it becomes a problem, you see. Whereas a lot of people do it in reverse. They make the mountain out of the molehill. The CEO is reverse of that. Trump brings a lot of those boardroom principles into the White House. It's what he's doing. And by that roll in the sleeve up mentality, Michael, what's happened is he tackles these problems. And as you're talking about the trade deals, you know, it dawned on me something here I want to talk to you about right after this pause a moment here. And that's this. There's only, how do you say this? There's only so much political power. Let's call it political capital, really. It is what it is, people. It's political capital. So every president, you get a certain amount of political capital. You have to decide where you're going to spend that political capital, you see. And you can really only do so much. You only got so many hours of the day and so much of an agenda. And this president clearly has hit the ground running in a lot of ways. Now, when I talk about the debt and the problem, I think that debt is going to come around. And once the Americans start seeing that this number is approaching over $30 trillion, if it gets anywhere near that, and it's headed there, people, I think you will see that on the national headlines will be, it'll be a massive problem. But this president, to his credit, has put a lot of attention into these upside down trade deals. And we have been really, as I've stated to you before, become the world's bitch over decades of abuse. And this goes through Republicans and Democratic administrations alike over decades, people. That's the problem. Trump is sort of like your cleanup hitter. You know, you bring somebody in who can clean things up a little bit and hopefully hit a home run or two, so you have a potential to win the game. That's kind of the way I see some of that, actually. But I think the effort that's put into the trade deals in Trump's mind is to produce the revenue streams for our country, to right the wrongs, and to bring prosperity back to what Michael was talking about, the forgotten man and the forgotten woman. If you think about that, that's where the rubber meets the road. And I got to tell you, frankly, it was probably a brilliant move to tackle that more than even the debt initially, because if you can get the revenue streams open and you can get people thinking in those terms and get the economy flourishing in the way that he has, well then, friends, you have a challenge to be able to do other things and back to that list and maybe hopefully tackle things like the debt and other things. Interesting thought process here. We'll continue on in just a moment here.
Our global experts are brilliant writers and engaging hosts on a mission of a lifetime. You'll find the latest news and inspiration on the front page of AmericaOutloud.com.
I'm going to ask you to go to thewoundedblue.org. That's www.thewoundedblue.org. That is the website for the organization that is the National Association for Injured and Disabled Police Officers. It is a support organization for these men and women who have given so much in the line of duty. We desperately need your help to raise money to get this movement going. And if you are a GoFundMe-er, go to GoFundMe, look up The Wounded Blue, and you can give there as well. But check it out, please, and also check out our film, The Wounded Blue, on Amazon.com.
Got to do something first to create prosperity. And I think to Trump's credit, let me ask Michael Johns that question, but in a very interesting sort of way. I think by really getting to those trade deals, I think that was pretty brilliant, wasn't it?
I think brilliant from a policy standpoint and a political standpoint. Policy, because it's very difficult to envision how the country's going to move forward without with these issues as flawed as they were. And from a political standpoint, also brilliant because it allowed the American people to feel an immediate stake in the success of his initiatives. So there was immediate buy-in. I think it's one of the reasons you see such great loyalty to this president among his followers, me included, is that you can see immediate payoff from the initiatives that he's pursuing in trade, in immigration, in tax cuts, in regulatory reform, all of these issues.
Which is what he ran on. That's what he ran on.
Which were the ones he ran on, and they were the points he ran on, and then the points he tackled first have been ones that have a direct dividend to the country. Now, he's been hurt by the fact that he has not, for the last year, in my view, for the last 3 years, really benefited from having a Congress that is in lockstep with helping him. And that has limited some of his ability to get these things done. We clearly still don't have the border wall that he promised. We still have trade agreements. Even some of these overhauls are going to require, Congress ultimately to ratify them.
Michael, why would Congress help him at this point? Tell me why that is, please.
Not out of necessarily any loyalty to him, but because that's for sure. But because they all have to go back in 2020 and say, "Look, here's what we did." So if you're hypothetically a, you know, House Democrat, mm-hmm, who's coming up on a re-election bid in 2020, and you're going to go back and talk about how you spent the last 2 years attempting to uncover this collusion issue and lie that's been perpetuated to the American people, that right, has never resonated as a top concern of the American voter, you're going to have a real tough time selling the case for another 2 years of incumbency, and you're going to be very susceptible to, I think, a challenge.
When Obama was in office, though, we didn't help him either.
I think in large part, and our Tea Party movement was right at the forefront of this, we did not help Obama. Not importantly for a complete rejection of it. Obama, when he went out to Missouri, said, "Hey, I'm happy to meet with the Tea Party movement. They want to come in and talk about entitlement reform or other issues." We took him up on that. We sent a certified letter to the White House offering to meet with him. There was never an interest in the Obama administration collaborating with people of moderate or conservative political persuasion. It was a very insular administration that really wanted to do everything by itself. and just try to close everyone else out as enemies rhetorically and functionally. I don't see that with this president. I don't think he's getting the reciprocity that he warrants and deserves. But this president, from the very beginning, has said he's willing to work with anyone and everyone who is committed to making the country great again. That should include all 535 members of Congress, but it's included, unfortunately, just a small number.
Let me talk about that a moment, making the country great again, because there are two things that just came to my mind I want to talk to you about as far as making the country great again. A lot of this is sort of like treating a patient who may have cancer or disease or something. And fundamentally, I've been talking about the debt, but if there were two things I could do as president, or two things I could do to fix the health of the patient, the country we're speaking about here, of United States of America people, there are two things I could do, Michael, and tell me if you disagree with this, but they would be this. I would enact term limits. Just give me term limits. And the second thing is, give me a balanced budget amendment. If you give me those two things, Michael, all I need is two things. Just give me those two things, please. Give me term limits and give me a balanced budget amendment. I could fix the cancer or disease in the patient. You agree or disagree with that?
I partly agree, but I think the challenge with both, we talk about term limits, we only talk about Congress, unfortunately. But when you look at where this longevity of service has been to the detriment of the American people, it's not just been Congress. At least they've been had to go back and get reelected, but it's also been our career bureaucracy, which, as this president has clearly uncovered and discovered, is no ally of reform in the system.
You bring up a great point.
So the idea of congressional term limits is a great idea.
Yeah.
I've always pointed out that it's a great idea if it's done in coordination with limiting the bureaucracy and its term, because those people are not elected. They're not, most of them were not even political appointees. They're accountable essentially to no one, and they're impossible to fire. And they are the you know, in a sense, the bureaucrats are the ones that have controlled and put limits on populist movements in the country. They found all kinds of creative ways of blocking.
All right, give me three things then, Michael. Give me three then, please. Three.
Well,
and the third one is I want to put term limits on those cats there, yeah?
Yeah, here are three things that are just undeniable. We got to grow jobs and wages on the economic front. We still have too many Americans not in the workforce, even though things are trending positively. Tens of millions of working-age Americans not in the workforce. That's got to be resolved. We're going to see wages increasing. I'm going to put that as category one. Category two is we've got to, as the president's trying to, resolve this immigration crisis. We are flooding this country with poor immigrants who are going to compete for jobs that are driving wages down, that are contributing to unemployment, in many cases contributing to crime and social turmoil in the country. We've got to resolve that. And the third is we've got to defend our interests globally. Fortunately, after the end of the Cold War, we don't have as persistent and sizable of a threat as we had in the Soviet Union. But Russia, China, and Iran, and perhaps North Korea, those four entities continue to represent a very significant threat to the security of this country. And, you know, all you can have all the best fiscal policies in the world, all the best economic policies, you can have the best immigration program in the world, but if you can't secure the homeland...
Well, I would argue that's the first thing, Michael, not the third or fourth.
Yeah, from an inverse standpoint, you might say nothing else matters if you can't
get
the security part of it right.
100%.
And clearly, as we're seeing in Iran, particularly right now, and China, particularly right now, those are really significant external threats to the security of this country and its interests.
When you start a movement, let's talk about a grassroots movement a moment, please. And this is kind of interesting because I've had a lot of people get my attention recently that they're asking me to start a grassroots movement, America Out Loud. They want to do something with this. People want to change the trajectory of where we're headed. They feel threatened, Michael. A lot of people feel threatened. You know that. You see it all over social media. People are threatened today. They just see the threats are very real and in our face. And they're no longer taking it as a joke here. It's not funny anymore. And so when you co-founded the Tea Party, and I want to talk about that because that was a grassroots movement, and to me a very successful one, I really was thrilled with the Tea Party. I just thought it was, because understand something, Michael. I had become disengaged and disenfranchised with the Republican Party years before the Tea Party became the Tea Party. I had already, like a bad drunken uncle, I had already dismantled, I already pulled them out of my will, you understand? And I had already said, you know, they're out of there, because I've seen what government does. I see how unuseful they are in our lives. And so when the Tea Party sparked all that, I was very, very interested, and the grassroots movement was really interested. Now, how could we do that again today, buddy? How?
In part, some of the things you're doing is central to it. I mean, as you need, it can't be a one-way conversation with American people. It's got to be a two-way conversation. Meaning, and I think that's the genius of the Tea Party movement, is we said, hey, look, these three founding principles are core to the founding of our country, and they're core to the future success of our country. Those are not compromisable. But beyond that, you know, we want your input. How do we best advance them? And what might work best in Arkansas might not be what works best, say, in New York City, meaning you've got a lot of variables there. Mm-hmm. And you got to afford the opportunity for people to give their input into it and feel that they're invested in it and actually be invested in it. That's crucial to the success of any grassroots movement, is the perspective of grassroots members seeing immediate dividends to their work. And the other key to our success, in my judgment, was that we didn't make it enormously complicated to get involved, because we had so many national, local organizations that emerged that really had no barrier to entry. I mean, the downside to that is it becomes very difficult to kind of, you know, control and manage, but that was less important to us than making sure that anyone who wanted to get involved, who subscribed to those three founding principles, had the ability to do so, could do so very easily. They could sign up on an email list, they could attend a meeting, they could run for an office in a local Tea Party organization, and they could become legitimate Tea Party leaders and activists. And tens of millions did, in part because of the simplicity of the message, because we listened to them, and in part, finally, because we gave them ease of access to becoming involved. And that's one thing I think, from a political party standpoint, that the Republican Party, which best represents my own perspective among major parties, has not done well, is that they become very difficult to work with and within. So, you know, it's very consultant-oriented, it's very heavily micromanaged at a national level, and it's become very difficult for a local person to say, you know, I want to get politically involved, I'm going to go get involved in the Republican Party. There's too many barriers, too many walls between that conclusion of an activist reaching that position and they're actually becoming engaged. And I've seen that throughout the country, just about in every state and every capacity, from individuals trying to run to local office to trying to run as delegates to the convention. There's just too many barriers that arise. And so that's been the key to the success of the Tea Party movement, is to not have as many of those barriers, and to make the founding principles simple and easy to understand and broadly applicable. And then to make it a movement literally of the people, meaning the Tea Party movement benefited from some strong leadership, but ultimately that leadership, would have, including my own, would have meant nothing if we didn't have the masses of people that were willing to act on the important initiatives that we put forward. And we started with winning back the Congress. We said, you know, I said in 2009 when we founded this movement, the easiest thing for me would have been to have said, you know, we're going to try to make a few improvements here and there in our political system. We didn't say that. We said, we're going to take back our government.
I remember that.
Bold, yeah. Very bold. It was very bold.
Well, isn't that where a lot of the Freedom Caucus came from as well?
Well, in fact, the Freedom Caucus was founded as the Tea Party Caucus. Michelle That's Bachmann, right. Who was a Tea Party congresswoman, was the first leader of that. And the caucus has continued to represent Tea Party sentiment within the House of Representatives, and is a great source.
It's more conservatism government. I mean, they definitely have good principles there in the Freedom Caucus. We need more of them, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think that's the key, is, you know, we have a lot of elected Republicans who have forgotten these founding principles or have backed off of them, who have been susceptible to lobbyist pressure or the pressure of the swamp, and, you know, go down there originally saying, hey, I'm going to change Washington, but quickly become a part of it. And sadly, the American people haven't always seen through that, because if you look at the sentiment of the American people, they hate Congress. There is no support for Congress in this country. We continue to hear that we don't have a particularly popular president. The support for Congress is a fraction of what it is for President Trump. President Trump is immensely more popular than the Congress as an entity. So then when you break it down to individually, so what, how do you feel about your particular congressman? Oh, they love him. He's great. He's the exception.
Yeah, it's a weird juxtaposition, isn't it?
He's always the exception to the rule. And that's just the reality of politics, is we get these individuals who, you know, by their ability to control grants into their districts and federal funding.
Well, it's somebody else's congressman. It's not mine, buddy, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You see that a lot, and they you do hear that a lot, where they but you're right. I just did a program just the last couple of days, and their ratings hover between 17% and 20%, Congress does. Right. And that's on a good day, by the way.
That's generous. Yeah, I've seen high single digits, in fact.
Right. It's been high. Yeah, it's been higher as well, but it's been a long time. In fact, the stats of Congress have dropped over the last 20 years. It's been stagnated now for the last 15. It can't get above that 20 mark, really. That's pretty low, buddy. It's pretty low.
It is. And it points to some great dysfunction within Congress, is that, you know, we right now have a House of Representatives that defines success as just not giving Trump any victories.
Well, that's it.
That might be the way that they've decided to manage things politically, but that's not what the voters back home, including...
You think they pay a price for this? You think they pay a price in the election?
I do. I think the prospects for Republicans reclaiming Congress, particularly if they can draw to the dysfunction and lack of success and the few pieces of major legislation and their inability to work with this president, I think it's immensely promising that Republicans take back the House, particularly if they take it back saying, I'm going to work with President Trump. You know, that is what the American people want to see, is that they want to see that their president is at least getting a decent amount of consideration for his initiatives in Congress. Not that necessarily a rubber stamp, but at least he's getting a due consideration. And we have a Congress that, you know, in the Democratic Party, it's hard pressed to even get him to meet with Trump or Trump administration officials. That's how uncooperative they have chosen to be.
Yeah. Now, the Tea Party movement itself, you see, you know, a lot of people think it's gone away. But you told me, I mean, it's active. It's still active today, as it has been. But there hasn't been the publicity around it. Why is that, Michael?
Well, I think that when, as an external political force in 2009, everything we did was prominent because it was inevitably, it had to be done in to great public fanfare, and it was opposed to the administration. Opposition, I think, always seems to get a little more attention than the grandeur details of governance. But what happened between 2009 and 2019 is, you know, we got dozens upon dozens of members elected in the House. This Senate is a Tea Party, largely Tea Party friendly Senate, maybe not on leadership level, but, you know, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, all of these are guys who ran not as Republicans who supported the Tea Party movement. They ran as Tea Party Republicans. They said, I am part of this, you know? So in essence, the graduation of the Tea Party movement has been one from an completely external force with no indigenous political power to becoming a force that has political power on the federal, state, and local levels. So that has created new complexities, new challenges, but it also has created a culture where the Tea Party movement has become part of the working machinations of government, as opposed to just exclusively an external force. And in some respects, when that happens, it's a lower profile that is taken on, but I believe these three founding principles are so critical to the future of the country and so broadly supported that there's no risk of the Tea Party movement going away. It's an issue of what is the Tea Party movement in its second decade going to become, represent, how is it going to go about things, what are going to be its methodologies that it pursues for influencing the future of the country.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it out there, too. And, you know, you just mentioned Ted Cruz, and you forget how associated he was with the Tea Party, because you don't hear this anymore. You're right. It leaves your memory bank a little bit, because you just don't see the headlines anymore. But he was very associated with that, and it doesn't come up anymore. So I think exposure-wise, you don't hear any more stories, you don't see any more. So people, you know, it's that old saying that, yeah, they tend to forget. It, you know, is the what do they call the greasy wheel there? Squeaky wheel gets the grease, I guess.
Well, and also let's be fair. You know, every day I'll read a news publication or news article about some small rally on some far left initiative that's given very prominent coverage, and you look at, you know, events that we've had of 5, 10, 20, in some cases 30,000 people that have been completely neglected by mainstream media, that a lot of the activities of this movement on the local and national levels have not been beneficiaries of friendly media. They sought first to ignore it, then they kind of sought to misrepresent it, and then they kind of sought to delegitimize it. They've, you know, largely not been terribly objective in the way that they've covered it, but it might not be as bad as some of the critics say.
It's like everything. They make the opposing viewpoint in evil, pariah, is what they did with the Tea Party. I mean, but it was that whole faction there. I mean, they had the Tea Party as evil people. I mean, I remember the media talking points from the left. But again, part of that problem, Michael, is that the left owns all the media. They run all the media empires
My pushback, I always push back on that, though, and I say, look, it is true that the left controls all of these institutions, but they control them because we've allowed it to happen.
Amen. And,
you know, so like,
I'm with you.
The easiest thing to say is, well, of course, we're not going to get a fair shake, and our ideas are going to get suppressed and misrepresented.
What about that?
Because we don't control those institutions, so that's the easy way out. The harder way out, and the better way out of this mess, in my view, is to say that our failure to ensure proper representation in these hugely influential societal institutions over the last four decades, especially, has been a crucial oversight mistake of the conservative movement in this country. And if we, you know, so we have got to say, you know, media matters, academia matters, our political culture matters, our you know, TV, film, all this stuff matters in the way people look at the world.
Yeah. Then we got work to do, buddy.
We cannot have a country where, in my judgment, like two-thirds plus subscribe to Tea Party sentiments, but our representation in these institutions is like,
it's nil.
You know, somewhere between 0% and 5%.
That's it. It's nil.
That's a challenge for the conservative movement. It can never be used as an excuse.
I think that's the challenge of the future, actually, is what we just laid out there, Michael, because I've been talking about this issue. You talk about a grassroots movement we were just talking about. That actually, what we're talking about right now is something I want to talk back to you more about this year, back to the grassroots movement. But you just said it so well. If we're between 0% and 5%, we're nil. And that's exactly, the conservative movement has absolutely done it to themselves. Time for all of us, and it's time for you out there to get involved and get loud.